You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Pit Pass Moto, the show that brings you interviews with the motorcycle industry insiders and racers that make this sport move. I'm Clint Esposito.
And I'm Heather Wilson.
Today, we're going to open up a little bit talking about the final three rounds of the SMX have been announced. So we're going to go over where they are and when they are.
Yeah, so the Super Motocross World Championship playoffs were just announced recently, and the host cities for that are going to be Charlotte, Fort Worth, and Las Vegas. So it's going to be a long season for the racers who are competing in Monster Energy AMA Supercross and the Pro Motocross Championship, but eventually in September, they're going to end up at those three venues if they're lucky enough to tabulate enough points.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a long season, and this actually forces some people, I think, that might only race Supercross to at least think about racing motocross too, so that they can get enough points, to qualify for the SMX, which is where the big money is made, I'm told.
Yeah, and basically the top 20 combined from Supercross and Pro Motocross points are going to be seeded into those playoff rounds. And I think this has been such a long time coming. Last year, I believe, was the first year for the playoffs, if I'm not mistaken. But to be able to kind of take those two disciplines and combine the points to have a really stretched out season is something that's pretty unique and gives racers something to look forward to, I guess, all year long, no matter kind of what happens during each of those respective seasons.
Yeah, I do know that they kind of copied the format from NASCAR because NASCAR does have like a championship series at the end. So I think that's what they tried to do. I do know that also that at least one of them took place of what Monster Energy Cup was. So they already had kind of like a placeholder event at the end of the year. And it basically evolved into now being the championship series.
That's true. I forgot about the Monster Cup and I had the opportunity to go to that, I think either once or twice. I lived out in California about a decade ago and remember making that drive from California to Vegas to attend that event. And what's kind of crazy is that is actually like a pretty small venue. I think they were playing at UNLV and it was like a much smaller venue than you would picture for that type of event, but it was a really cool event nonetheless.
I want to say that's why they probably didn't do the SMX there last year because they were looking for another venue that was a little bit bigger. Because I know for SMX, they're trying to make it more of a middle ground between motocross and supercross. So they are taking all the SMX rounds are at speedways or drag strips, someplace where they have a little bit bigger of a footprint to actually make the track. That also lends itself to being outdoors, and now weather can be a factor.
Yeah, definitely. And that can be a game changer in any type of race, when it rains, when it's really hot, if it's really dusty. That definitely plays into the experience for not only the racer, but the fan.
Absolutely. I think we're probably safe with Vegas and rain. But
crazier things have happened, right? I think the Texas one is going to be really cool, headed to Fort Worth. So I was actually down in Fort Worth in November, kind of the first time that I'd ever been there. And it's a really unique city to visit and be in with like the Fort Worth Stockyards and lots of cowboy and rodeo history there. So I think that'll be really neat to kind of incorporate that into people's trips.
Sounds like a Aaron Plessinger fan central with the cowboy hats.
He would love that. Yeah. They better be planning a PR opportunity for him there. That's for sure.
They're making an extra cowboy hat.
Between Supercross and Motocross, they're going to have 28 rounds plus these three playoffs. That's a really long season. Are there going to be riders that can keep it together injury free during that whole time?
That's really the question, right? I mean, Supercross and motocross are dangerous on their own. And now you have to survive both of them to even make it to the big championship. So, you know, I guess that's as long as you get enough points, though, built up between both series, then at least you can get in. So you're not totally reliant on one series to get in. Or is it the way it says, combined? So they're just combining your points. So I guess if you like won a ton of supercrosses and then didn't race outdoors, maybe you'd still be in the top 20.
It's so hard to even make predictions because even if you feel like you're not doing that well, you know, something happened, you didn't get a ton of points, but it's really like up to your competitors in a way as well, because did they get injured and have to sit rounds out? Did they not do well? Like, just because you didn't necessarily score high doesn't mean that you still don't have an opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know from last year that the order that they're in when they enter the playoffs doesn't necessarily, I think they like carry a couple points over, but it's not like you have a huge lead over anybody else. It kind of goes back to zero, so that way everybody's got a chance once you get into the playoffs. And you know, for us fans, it's just we get more races to watch. We're like, we don't care how much they have to ride or how little vacation time they get. We get stuff to watch. So
yeah, that's true. And I mean, keeping up with all these different series that I watch and keep up with, and the different point I guess rule books, in a way, it can be really a head spin trying to keep track of how each discipline, each series is calculating points.
So I do know that they actually change. I don't remember, but Supercross and Motocross had a different point scale. And I want to say it was just last year or the year before. And they actually went to the same point scale. So one was giving like 26 points for a win and the other one was giving 25. But now they actually went to the same point scale. So that way it's a little bit more uniform, which actually, let's talk about the whole overview of super motocross in general and the fact that now they even acknowledge each other. Because I would say for the 15 years prior to this, they acted like the other series wasn't even, like it didn't even exist.
Yeah, or maybe we're in competition with each other a little bit. Had very Absolutely. Different views and philosophies on things, very different organizations. And so the fact that they came together to make something happen collaboratively is like impressive.
I agree. I think their hand was forced a little bit by WSX, by the World Supercross, but they have tried to pretend like that wasn't the case. But I think that, you know, I think in any event, one, it's more events for us to watch, but it also pushed the needle a little bit with the US series to make some upgrades or some changes.
Yeah, and I think that the bigger the series is, you know, the more events, the bigger venues, the more, you know, opportunities there is, then it's basically going to just continue to lead to more awareness for the sport and hopefully more direct or primetime TV time rather than apps or being pushed really late at night. I did like the improvement this year with moving the races up so they were more reasonable times, reasonable starting times for people that are on Eastern time. So that was nice because a lot of nights, if it was a Pacific time zone race, I was asleep.
Yeah, you and me both. I would have to nap just so I could try to catch the heat races and then fall asleep for the main.
But yeah, bikes. I mean, Daytona Bike Week just took place a week or two ago and lots of events surrounding kind of the Bike Week festivities with Supercross and then the Daytona 200. So lots of opportunities for fans to get in on all the action for racing.
Yeah, Friday night before Supercross, they even did an arena cross in Daytona. So yeah, full week of events. I know they have off-road races there as well. So, I mean, I would say, as far as bike rallies go, this one definitely, and I guess I would assume that the rally was there first and then all these other events kind of, you know, decided to take part, but no other rallies are like that. If you go, it's like the rally themselves may host an event, but the amount of events, like if you are really a motorcycle enthusiast more than just want to ride around and drink beers downtown, you could actually go to tons of high level pro events in Daytona. So that's what makes, I would say, Daytona Bike Week a little bit cooler than all the other rallies, is just because the whole motorcycle industry has rallied behind it and put their events in the same area at the same time. All right, and today we're going to welcome our guest, the one and only Steve Sommerfeld. What's up, Steven?
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
So Steven is also an ex-freestyle motocross rider. He also was a manager for two very big freestyle motocross riders you may have heard of, Josh Sheehan and Clinton Moore.
Yeah. So, I mean, getting started with managing athletes, how did you get into that? And what did that really entail?
By accident. And it entailed a lot of work that I never expected.
Yeah.
It came about by being on a 7-week tour in Indonesia. We got to the last stop. We're in Jakarta sitting. We're in a swimming pool working. We're all working on different tricks. And, by the end of it, I realized that the guys needed a bit of a hand, and I had a university degree that I hadn't used for a couple of years in management and marketing. And I just said, hey, throwing it out there, if you want me to help you, I could. Let's try it. And very quickly, within 6 months, we had Clinton and Josh in the biggest events in the world.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically reaching out to venues or like booking them for different events?
Yeah, exactly. So X Games, Red Bull X Fighters, Night of the Jumps World Championships, Nitro Circus. Then it went on to, once they're in those major events and they were doing really well, then came the Red Bull sponsorship for Sheeny, Rockstar Energy for Clinton, and yeah, just a whole lot of scheduling. And yeah, there was a lot more work than I ever thought possible.
Yeah. So a lot of the admin, logistics, conversations, all the stuff that most riders or racers hate to handle.
Yeah. And myself included. Do not worry about that. It's not something I enjoy doing, but it was something that I did know that I could handle while they were, at that time, they were trying to be the best, and they both went on to do that. They both went on to win Red Bull X Fighters and X Games medals. And it was awesome. It was one of the coolest things.
And you did it because you got paid.
Well, to be honest, I really shot myself in the foot in the payment department, because we were friends. So to me, it was never about money. And kind of like the bittersweet moment out of it all was when, I think it was actually when Josh won X Fighters, and I realized as a one, and by then it was a two-man party, which was, I convinced my wife to quit her really good job to work with me, because I was crashing riding freestyle myself while I was trying to manage Josh and Clinton. I was spending too much time on the business side of things, and I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't focusing like I should on my own riding. Mm. So my wife came over, but the thing was, Josh had become so big and he was working on such big stuff. Clinton as well. And when Josh won Red Bull X Fighters, the world tour, we both knew at that point that I could not help them anymore. So we mutually just said, okay, you need a far bigger company who does far bigger deals than I could ever do. Getting them shows, that was easy. That was not a problem. And by the time they got to that point, they could also do that themselves. That was very easy to do. Sponsorships, that was the tough one that I don't know if it's a dark art, but to be honest, it's more like, it's not what you know, it's who you know. So it was a very bittersweet moment. It was a thing that I would love to continue working with those guys, but I just knew I didn't have the contacts behind me to make it bigger for them.
I like that that whole story started with you being like, we were in a hot tub talking about tricks we were working on, and you just realized you weren't working that good at tricks.
Basically, I was working on, let's say doing a double grab or a rock solid or a seat grab or something in the swimming pool. Clinton Moore, and I could be mixing stories here, but I really don't think I am. He worked out how Kyle Loza did this one body varial called the Electric Doom, and he worked it out. It was something very small that most people would never notice, but Clinton had figured it
out. Which became the Bundy.
Which became the Bundy, became Clinton's trick that he then developed even bigger. that's when I realized these two guys were on a whole other level that I was not even thinking about. So I'm like, you guys need a hand. I'm not going to go to that level. So let me use my brain instead of crashing too much more.
And you guys will find me after the show Googling all these freestyle motocross terms and all these tricks. And I hope there are like diagrams and videos and all this stuff.
I am terribly sorry. If I knew, I could have brought a motorbike into here and I could have done some demonstrations for you.
There's so many segments of motorcycling, so it's all really fascinating to me. And Clint's the expert on that kind of stuff, but I'm learning.
You'll learn a lot more from him.
Well, you didn't even go that far away from the manager deal, though, because you now handle riders for Night of the Jumps.
Yeah. So
I feel like now instead of doing two people, now you're dealing with like 10 riders.
Plus the rest, actually. So at the same time that I was working with Josh and Clinton, I got them into Night of the Jumps. I then met the team here at Night of the Jumps because it was cheaper for me to book flights out of Australia to Europe and to China. Well, actually more to Europe. It was cheaper for me to book flights to Europe and I would go as their excess baggage. Excess baggage is so expensive from Australia to Europe, it was cheaper for me to fly and take an extra bag. So I came and we ended up doing, I think, Alvaro Delfara. He's an Italian FMX rider. He had a show in, I think it was like Bologna or something like that. My wife and I both got to fly for free because it was cheaper than Clinton and Josh bringing their stuff. So
Wow. We
were traveling the world just as excess baggage. But the cool thing was I got to meet the guys at Night of the Jumps because of that. Then one time they needed a judge. Well, as the way goes, I think it was Clinton. Clinton hurt himself, so he couldn't compete. So there was no, you know, conflict of interest. So, okay, no problem. I'll judge. I'll fill in because somebody couldn't make it. Then there was the part where I read one of their press releases. And so it's a German company. I'm living in Germany now. It's a German company. And I was reading the English text that they were sending out. I'm like, it's not reading that great. Let me just give it a little sprinkling of first language English. So then I started doing their press releases. And then they had a Russian, actually. Some crazy Russian dude was their TV host for the international side, and he couldn't make it for one event. So then they needed a TV host. Okay, well, Steve's the only guy here who speaks English as a first language. Hey, do you want to be the host? All right, no problems. So it just kept, like, slowly over 7 years built into now I'm after my crash, which put me out, so my career-ending crash. The two bosses, Jörg and Marco, I'd worked with them by that point, by like 5, 6, 7 years. And they asked me to take over the rider management role. And I said no twice, actually. They asked me twice because I thought I was going to ride again. I didn't think my injury was as bad as it was. So I'm like, yep, thank you very much for the opportunity. Dream job. I've watched this for like 20 years in Australia as a kid. Like, it would be a dream to do this, but I know how much work is involved managing two guys. I don't need to manage 10 and try and ride. Anyway, after 1 year and running out of money, I decided that I still wasn't walking properly by then. I should probably take the job. And that's how it kind of happened.
Yeah. And so when I talked to you earlier, when I was stalking all of your social media, you said that you were getting ready to head back to school to learn German or take a German class. So how long have you lived in Germany and how's that class going?
The German class.
So this is the embarrassing part out of everything. I came over here. It's almost exactly 10 years ago. I flew in March 2014 for 2 months. My wife and I flew over. There was 5 events that I was going to judge at, coming from the Southern Hemisphere to the Northern Hemisphere. I didn't have enough winter clothes, put it that way, to handle a German winter. So I hated it. And then by the time the 2 months were up, it was starting to get, you know, coming into summer. And so we decided to change our flights. And so we thought, let's have 3 more months. And by then, some promoters knew that I was here, and then they asked me to do shows. So Night of the Jumps, actually, they gave me one of their KTMs to do a couple of shows. And then I picked up so many shows that we decided to change our flights again, and we stayed for an English Christmas because my wife was born in England, but she didn't really grow up there. So we thought, let's meet her family. And 2 months, 5 months, 11 months, it turned into now 10 years. Problem was, I've spent the whole time traveling around Europe and around the world, I never saw Germany as a home. I just saw it as a base. So I never bothered to learn German. COVID hits. I had to stay. And then I realized how bad my German was. And then we live here. And yeah, it's terrible.
Well, don't you need it to get your...
Yeah. So the other funny part of that is, so my wife was born in England, but she grew up her whole life in Australia. She never had her English passport, but she was entitled to it. The first year we lived here was under like just a regular kind of 1 year visa for Aussies to come to Germany. But then after that, I had to try get a work visa. My wife was English, so she could just get her passport, which we did. So she could stay. That was no problem. And I filled out all the paperwork as a, what was I? I was an artist, a freelance artist, something like that. And when you write down freestyle motocross as your occupation, and then the German, the sehr, the really strong German lady, sehr stark Frau, she says, was ist freestyle motocross? And I'm like, kind of like dirt bikes, but Evel Knievel. So I jump and do backflips. And she's like, okay, how much money will you make? I'm like, well, I don't know. Like, it's freelance. It could be anything. Oh, well, I need to know how much you'll make per month. And I'm like, well, if I have 4 shows in a month, that's a really good month. I'm doing pretty good. If I crash at the first show, I could have a broken leg or worse, I could be out for a year. So I could make zero. She didn't like that answer and tore up my application. So
dang it for being honest.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, honesty is always not always the best policy.
Well, I was kind of, yeah, like I was kind of joking around with the whole thing. I'm like, yeah, you know, like it could be, I could make 100,000, I could make zero. Like,
I don't think Germans are like, I don't, get joke like jokes. I mean, I was over there about 10 years ago too. And yeah, they're pretty serious, I feel like.
Yeah. And I should have thought about that in the visa office, but you know, I didn't think it was that big of a deal. Like, this job has supported me for 15 years. My wife quit her job to work with me. Like, this is our life. So I really didn't think it was an issue. And they tore up my application. So then,
and you weren't even injured at that point, right?
No. Like, I was flying high. Like, they were the best years of my life. And so my wife pulls out her freshly printed passport. It was like 2 weeks old. The ink was not even dry. And she's like, what about my English passport? Does that work? And they're like, oh, are you married? I'm like, yeah. Oh, okay. Go to level 2. In 15 minutes, I had a passport. Not a passport, sorry, I had a visa. But yeah, after Brexit happened a few years ago where England or the UK decided they didn't want to be part of Europe, there goes our kind of rights. So it's only lucky that we've lived here so long that we can kind of stay. So So we can live in Germany for the rest of our lives if we want to, because we've been here so long.
So how often do you travel outside of Germany now for work? For booking shows and stuff?
Since COVID, that's a tough question because everything died. Like, all events just shut up shop and it all disappeared.
Do you feel like it's coming back now though?
It is, yeah. So the light is at the end of the tunnel. It's still slow. I would say what I found, I work with Night of the Jumps and they're big events. They're in big arenas and big stadiums. I feel like for the bigger events, it's taken longer because there's more risk behind putting that event on. There's more money that goes in. There's more infrastructure. I remember it was not last year, it was the year before. We were lucky. We went to do a show in Cologne in Germany. We got our event done, but the music concert, I can't remember what band it was, they were the week before in Cologne. They had to cancel because they couldn't even find enough guys to do the rigging and put up the scaffolding for the stage. So everything else was ready to go. All the pyro was ready, the musicians, they just couldn't build the stage because they couldn't find enough workers with the correct things, you know.
Are they union or something there?
No. They just couldn't find the people.
Like, if you go to do a Monster Jam or something in New York, you're going to have some random union, like, loader driver trying to build you a landing. Oh. And you're just, like, trying to sit there explain to them.
Wait, so you can't build your own landing?
They can't even have the normal track crew that works with Monster Jam. They can't even run the machines.
No way.
It's literally a New York union operator. And you can imagine what the landing looks like.
Yeah, it would be horrible.
Random dude that has zero idea what's going on built it.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, dude, we don't deal with that.
The first one, when I walked in, it looked like an Evel Knievel landing.
Oh, no.
And I was like, no. We need to push that thing like straight up.
It's got to go high and it's got to be steep. You know,
keep pushing her up.
Oh, no way. So that actually makes a lot of sense for all the kind of, New York TV shows where you see them talking about the unions and all that sort of. Okay, so you've had to deal with that in FMX. I thought that was just like construction and people being put in the concrete under a building or something.
Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, that's the one. I don't know much about America, but I do know Jimmy Hoffa.
They think he's under the Meadowlands is the conspiracy.
So, I mean, talking about construction of these ramps for these shows and stuff, I saw on your website, Steve, that you have some plans for different ramps.
Yeah.
Is that stuff that you've kind of engineered or designed or figured out over time?
No. So none of those are my plans, actually. I asked each of the either people or the groups or the designers who created those ones if they were happy to freely give them away. So a big thing in freestyle motocross is, as Clint just said, like if you've got some union guy who doesn't know how to build a landing, they're going to build it wrong. And so landings are the second most important thing. Probably the most important is the up ramp itself, the jump. And Clint has jumped probably the worst jumps in the world. I have jumped the worst jumps in the world. When somebody doesn't know the right size, the right radius, what materials to use, it is, unfortunately, in our sport, it is life and death. And so I wanted to give those plans away to anyone and everyone who wants to jump a dirt bike to build what we all want to ride and what will be at any event. Or if some young kid in, I don't know, Arizona wants to start riding, he can build his own ramp. Just download it off of the website there, off Riders Lounge Podcast. Download it, build it. And if he goes to Clint's place or Cedar Grove MX, those ramps will be there if they want to go into an amateur competition. They will be the same ramps. And then if they get even better, they'll be the same ramps at X Games. They'll be the same ramps at Night of the Jumps. So it's just trying to build that standard, which has been there, but I've just seen too many people building the wrong ramps over years. So yeah, that's the reason.
It's even hard though, even with plans, because I've seen, one of the original ramps was called a Rev 3.
Yeah.
And I've seen about 15 different Rev 3s.
Absolutely.
I'm like, you built this with the same plans that guy did? How did you guys come up with this? What's going on?
Who followed the directions and who just kind of glanced at them?
100%.
Exactly. And that was actually... That was the exact thing that Levi Sherwood was discussing with me. So the new ramp that's kind of starting to come in now, it's called the Next Generation Ramp. Levi Sherwood, well, he's my favorite rider in terms of style. He's just so damn good. He's got the biggest tricks. He's got cool style. He won everything in 2017, and then he just retired at the absolute peak of his riding career. And he's a very industrious kind of guy. And so this ramp that he designed, he wanted that to be like the new standard because you could do more tricks off of it. It's bigger, it's scarier, but in his terms, it's safer because there's more time for you to get back on the bike when you're doing these big tricks. But you could also double flip this ramp, which you could also front flip. There's no other ramp that you could do these two completely opposite tricks on. And so his only real fear about putting these designs up is how does the person individually, how do they build it? So he tried to explain it as well as possible, But as we all know, every single ramp is different. As long as it's as close as possible,
yeah,
I hope we will have a better future for the sport.
And safety even, you know, at least if it's replicatable or you're not showing up to something that's totally foreign to you. So even just being like the kids are riding the same, like you said, similar enough where... Exactly. You can kind of, you know, it's like not going to be just totally like, I don't know what's going on here.
That's it. And like, even if you had the exact same ramp. So there's a guy here in Europe, actually, he's in Austria, Gerhard Meyer. He probably has the best ramps over here collectively that I've ridden. So he'll set up shows for everybody around here and he makes his ramps perfectly. They're all built exactly the same. And he connects the ramps together to go like 8 ramps wide, 4 ramps wide, whatever. They still feel different. As perfect as he built them, they're still a tiny bit. One feels a little bit poppier. The other one's a little bit smoother, whatever it might be. And then you've got the ground. Like you can talk about absolute 0 degrees. If the ground's 1 degree elevation, if it's 1 degree the other way, if it's 2 degrees, if it's 5 degrees, if there's a bump in the run-up, like there's so many variables. We're just trying to eliminate some of those variables.
And even whatever the ground is, if you're on sand or gravel,
exactly.
There's still a lot to account for.
That's it. Dirt. Loamy dirt, hard dirt. You might have some dust on top. Throw in mesh if you've got it. That's cool. Or you've got plywood. Or you've got rubber or sand, like you say, or there's bumps on the run. Like all of those things.
Elevation.
Oh God, don't even get me started on elevation. So this is an interesting part. When you talk about elevation, it went from the 2 strokes kind of struggling. If you get to, I don't know, feet. Let's say like 2,000 feet.
It's a little more than that where it really starts. Like 4 or 5, really start to be down on power.
Yeah. Okay. So 4,000 feet, that's starting to be a problem. That's where like the 450, 4 strokes, they came into their own. So the guys who are riding on a 450, they're still killing it. The guys on the 250, 2 strokes are barely even able to make the jump. Now throw in guys on a Stark Varg electric bike.
Ooh.
They don't have to think about elevation
anymore.
They have
zero change.
They have no change.
Even the 4-stroke, you're better off because one, it's injected, so it's just going to automatically tune itself to the elevation. And then two, you already have a baseline of more power.
Exactly.
So if you knock a teeny bit off, it's not that detrimental versus a 2-stroke.
Yeah.
You're going to probably be running like it's underwater. And you're going to be down on power. And the, like you said, the electric bike, same
thing. It's the exact same thing. There is no elevation issues.
So what you're saying is that it's like really technical, not only on the bike setup, but also the ramp setup, the facility setup. It's a lot of different calculations, not just from a fan perspective, sitting in the stands and going, ooh, they just did a backflip. Like,
no, there's so much going on. There's so much that goes into it. And if you want to talk about shows or competitions as well, every show is different. But if you've got people, okay, let's say it's just America. You could have a show in New York. You could have local riders within 100, 200 mile radius. And they come to that show, they're going to feel pretty good. If you've got somebody driving from California over to New York, they're going to be tired. They're not going to have the same feeling when they want to go ride their bike. Their eyes will be hanging out of their head. They'll then start to stress about, am I too tired to even do these tricks? If you want to throw in international riders with flights coming in, they then have to get on a bike that they do not know. So how good is this bike? Is it about to blow up? Is it brand new? Actually, do they have a good exhaust on there? Because I've got a crappy exhaust at home. They've got a good one. At home, I've got a good exhaust and theirs is not that good. Oh, that changes. So there's so many things that go into if you're going to compete at an event and you've got different riders from all around the world or even just the travel. It changes. Then there's the training times. How much time does a guy have to train? At our events, at the World Championships, we have collectively in one day 23 minutes. We'd put a couple of guys in a group and they'll just jump the ramps for 5 minutes. My brain's not even turned on in 5 minutes, but you have to have jumped every ramp. Then we have a meeting and say, okay, what's everybody think? Are the ramps at the right distance? Does everything feel good? Like, is this manageable? Of course, there'll be an argument because there's always an argument. But then, like, we'll make the changes if we absolutely decide that it's necessary, and especially for safety. Then you've got 2 8-minute training sessions. And by then, the guys are done. We need to shut everything down, close the doors, get everything prepped. Then it's time for the pit party. The fans come in for 1 hour. They meet the riders. Then it's showtime. Like, there's not much time to get used to a new venue. Maybe it's a new bike. Maybe you're dealing with jet lag or something like that. It's tough.
They have to be really adaptable individuals.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I will say this. Most people, I mean, I did go one time without my suspension, which was a terrible idea, but guys will bring their forks and shocks and then swap them onto the bike. So you at least, I would say, suspension. If you have bad suspension, it's going to be like terrible the whole time. So at least you bring your suspension, which elevation and all that stuff is not going to affect, and your handlebars. So that way you have the basics of the bike will at least physically feel like mine.
Kind of as I was explaining it before, like what I ride at home is like I try and keep everything as basic and bog stock as I can. I don't do anything to the engine. Until I got sponsored by a DEP for my exhaust, I always had stock exhausts. I kept everything as stock as possible. The only thing that I really traveled with, like you said, is suspension, handlebars, flip levers, and graphics just so my sponsors were on there. That was all I traveled with. Helmet, boots, maybe 2 pairs of underpants, and that's about it.
In case you come up short.
In case I come up short, I do have a spare pair because, as I said, excess baggage from Australia to Europe is very expensive, so I was not risking it.
I actually did. I cut my bars at one point in my career, and then I stopped because of exactly what you said. That way, if I had to buy bars, I could just get the bend, and then I wouldn't have to trim them down. I could just run them how they came.
That was my way of going about it. In my experience, that is not to be the best rider in the world. I never wanted to be the best rider in the world. I didn't want to risk it like Sheeny or Clinton or Levi or Travis or whoever. I was very happy being the B-grade dude. Like, I'll be in your top 6, top 8. I'm really happy to make that. If I can grab a podium, I'll take it. But if you look at the top dudes, that's where they were really fussy about engines and really fussy about every little thing. And I completely get it. Like, they were trying to completely push the limits and redefine the sport. So you had to change stuff around. But for the vast majority of us, like Clint and I, we were pretty stoked on good suspension. Let's just try not to break ankles and wrists.
All right. Well, Steve, thanks for being on our show today. And for our listeners that are out there, what are some ways that they can get in touch or follow you on social media?
For me personally, I don't do an awful lot because I'm retired now. The actual riding department, that's out the door. But if you do want to check it out, it's just Steve Sommerfeld on Instagram and wherever. But generally what I spend my time on now is the Riders Lounge podcast. So that's where I work with Clint a lot with our freestyle motocross, very specific and very niche topics, far more niche than what we've spoken about now. So Riders Lounge podcast is on pretty much all the platforms, and Night of the Jumps is the world championship that I work with. I'm very lucky that I get to work across with everybody. Like, I can work with Nitro and Masters of Dirt or X Games or whoever it might be, Red Bull X Fighters when they were on. So I kind of dabble all around the place.
We were talking about adaptability for those riders, and it sounds like that for your career too, with all the different transitions and places that you've had opportunities.
Yeah, I think that for me it was the key. If I was not adaptable, I would be working a real job. But life would probably be a lot easier, but wouldn't be as exciting.
If you enjoyed this episode, follow Pit Pass Moto wherever you get podcasts so you never miss an episode. You can also follow us on social media or visit pitpassmotorsports.com. There you will find our complete episode archive and other exclusive content. This has been a production of Evergreen Podcast. A special thanks to today's producer, Bridget Coyne, audio engineer, Gray Longfellow, and executive producer, Gerardo Orlando. I'm Heather Wilson.
And I'm Clint Esposito.
And we hope you'll join us next time for another episode of Pit Pass Moto.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.